Welcome to the podcast where heavy industrial industries meet the venture capital ecosystem, interviewing both thought-leading investors and pioneering founders to better understand the opportunities and challenges that lie ahead for digital industrial innovation. Your host is Ty Finley, and this is the Heavy Hitters Podcast.
Catherine Boyle joins us today from Miami. Catherine is a general partner at Andreessen Horowitz, where she co-founded the American Dynamism Investment Practice, focused on investments in companies that support the U.S. national interest and solve critical problems for the country. Before joining Andreessen, she was a partner at General Catalyst, and before starting her venture career, she was a reporter at the Washington Post. She has been involved with investments in Anderwall, Hadrian, and a host of other companies in our ecosystem. The content here is for informational purposes only and should not be taken as legal, business, tax, or investment advice, or be used to evaluate any investments or securities, and is not directed to investors or potential investors in any Andreessen fund. Catherine, clearly American dynamism has certainly exploded on the scene this year with a lot of buzz, and I am beyond excited to have you on and share more about what y'all are building. So welcome to the Heavy Hitters.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be on.
Awesome. Well, I gave a very short summary in my introduction, but give us the color commentary on your journey and what led you to joining Andreessen and ultimately building this American dynamism practice.
Sure. So, I mean, my journey is not the typical path to investing or to venture capital. As you mentioned, I started my career in Washington. I spent about 10 years in Washington and I spent, you know, a lot of time at the Washington Post as a reporter, general assignment reporter, and I was there before Jeff Bezos bought the paper. So I was convinced that the Washington Post at the time was about to go bankrupt. And I said, you know what, like, I need to go learn about this tech thing. It's all I write about. It's all we talk about as digital transformation. I should move to Silicon Valley. So I moved to Silicon Valley in 2014. And it, you know, I joke, lived all over the world, traveled all over the world. And moving to Silicon Valley from Washington was probably the greatest culture shock that I'd ever felt in my entire life. And what was the biggest surprise to me was, you know, I had always been under the impression from books I had read about the Valley, I hadn't spent that much time there, was that, you know, the kind of relationship between the technology sector, Silicon Valley, and Washington was actually a deep one, that government investment led to the creation of Silicon Valley. And so when I arrived in 2014 and there was no discussion of policy, no discussion of Washington's needs, and no discussion of defense, industrials, it was pretty surprising to me. And so the thing that I became most passionate about was, how do we bring software innovation? How do we bring true venture-backed companies into these sort of what we would call legacy companies, industrial companies, and most importantly, government companies that really haven't benefited from the broad private sector innovation that we've seen in the recent history of Silicon Valley? It's interesting. In 2014, 2015, 2016. Going in 2017, this was not a popular narrative. And what's been really just shocking, I'd say, and you know, pleasantly surprising, is that this narrative has really gained steam over the last 5-6 years, in that there need to be more companies working with the US government. There need to be more companies that are focused solely on the national interest, which is, you know, a broad definition, which I can go more into, but companies that really see themselves as partnering with the aims of all constituents and all citizens. And so, whereas I think the sort of, you know, Web 2 story of the 2010s to say 2015, 2016-ish is, you know, very much consumer internet. It's very much focused on sort of the app ecosystem. What we are seeing going in, you know, from COVID in 2020 into this next decade is that founders really want to build for the national interest. They really want to build hardware, software companies, and they really want to solve difficult problems. And so we're really excited that there's more and more founders and investors who are committed to this mission.
Could not be more aligned 100%. The timing is right, and love the background and the various skill sets it takes all to come and help lift boats in this ecosystem. So excited for you. And maybe then let's set the stage for the discussion. You know, most of our listeners likely know Andreessen Horowitz, but tell us a little bit about Andreessen generally, and then a high level about the American dynamism practice. And I think I actually caught some Twitter chatter that you recently hosted an American Dynamism Summit. So I had to ask you any real-time feedback loops that may have come out of that.
Sure. So you know, we were founded in 2009 by our founders, Mark Andreessen and Ben Horowitz. And I think the thing that really put us on the map, aside from you know, the kind of storied past and histories of Mark and Ben just being extraordinary builders was a 2011 essay that sort of solidified our view that software is eating the world. And of course, Mark wrote this in 2011 and talked about a number of companies that were really just transforming the world. And in some ways, it's interesting because when people hear software is eating the world, they focus on the software part and they focus on the eating part, how fast it's growing. And what's interesting about American dynamism is it's sort of, you know, 10 years on, Mark wrote It's Time to Build, and it was really focused on sort of his frustrations with how America was handling COVID. And he talks about this pretty openly that, you know, sitting and watching New York City, one of the greatest cities in the world, not be able to afford PPE or build PPE during the height of the pandemic in March, April, and May, you know, really lead him to say that we need to find ways to build for this country. And so it's interesting because I think American dynamism, what we've noticed about a lot of the companies we work with is, you know, these are companies that are really important to the national interest. They're physical in nature. They're the built world. But they also all incorporate software. And so one of, I think, the macro trends that we're betting on is that, you know, while, as I said, 2010 to 2015 was really focused on the app ecosystem, it was really focused on the virtual world. And a lot of, I'd say, you know, what we are known for as a firm has been sort of this focus on pure software. We're seeing it enter, you know, through companies like SpaceX, through companies like Anduril, we're seeing it enter some of the hardest legacy industries. And really that software companies are transforming these industries dramatically. So we're really excited. You know, you mentioned the American Dynamism Summit. It was the first time we brought together all of our founders in this category. One of the things that we are really proud about is that even though, you know, we're only a year into this practice being formed, we've been investing in these categories for 10 years, from Anduril, from companies like Astronis, you know, aerospace, defense. We've been investing in these categories, but we just didn't have a name for it, nor did we think that they were, you know, differentiated to build a category. And what we're seeing now is that there's so many founders, so many different needs about these companies, they really demand their own category, not only of investment, but category of how you build these companies.
Right on. Well, to your point, software eating the world. Well, we better not forget the half the GDP and the manufacturing, construction, transportation, housing that makes up this country. So again, biased audience, but very much aligned with you. And to use that last point as a segue about Andreessen investing specifically in these more legacy traditional industries. Andreessen, obviously, a name and brand that's iconic to everyone in the tech ecosystem, immediately recognizable, probably the understatement of this podcast. That said, other than maybe a lot of folks who've been following the portfolio closely over the years, they might not associate Andreessen with a focus on these areas like manufacturing, supply chain, defense, et cetera, legacy industries at the topic of this podcast. So let's set the record very clear here. Can you give us a little bit more about that genesis story of how the American Dynamism practice was formed, and what is that thesis in another layer that your team really did an amazing job? And I'll link this in our podcast episode. You had a very viral post early this year entitled "Investing in American Dynamism," where you laid it out. So let's give the soundbite version on the podcast of why it was formed and what you guys are looking at.
Certainly. Yeah. So, I mean, the co-founder of the practice with me is David Yulevich, and I was fortunate to meet him when we co-led the Anduril Series B. And so we joined the board, we spent a lot of time together. And what was interesting was, you know, this was, we met 2018, 2019. And what was really interesting about that time is that, like, people were starting to realize how important defense, national security, industrials, these categories were. But it was sort of a small cadre of people. You know, it's like you could count on one hand the people mm-hmm. who were really committed to investing in these categories. And so, you know, I always think, like, when you're building something new, and we give this advice to any sort of co-founder relationship, it's good when you've known each other for a long time, worked together, competed against each other. David and I like to talk about how we weren't exactly friends when we first met. We were competitors mm-hmm. and then became friends later once we were kind of aligned on the same mission. But I think, like, that's so important to the co-founding relationship, is like understanding that your mission aligned with what we're trying to do. And I really do think, you know, when we invested, you know, I had been involved in Anduril since 2017. And, you know, 2017 was a time where, you know, there were some true believers, some early believers, but, like, there weren't many people involved in this category. There were worries about, is there downstream capital? Are there growth investors who will invest in hardware? you know, part of, I think, you know, some of the early investments that happened in sort of the drone category, for example, a lot of drone companies went out of business because there just wasn't enough capital in the ecosystem to support the very difficult needs of building hardware. And so, I think, you know, what's changed and what I do think I would say COVID is partially the impetus for this is I do think people kind of woke up and realized that the physical world is important. For a very long time, Silicon Valley was just focused on the metaverse, just focused on software, just focused on companies that were you know, operating through a lean model, maybe not as capital intensive, but the physical world was seen as something that was very difficult. And especially if you were producing both hardware and software, this was something that investors just weren't as excited about. And so I really think that there's been a number of shocks to the system that led the investment community, led us as a firm to believe that this is the next category of investment. And then most importantly, and I really like to stress this to people who are sort of outside of the founder ecosystem, founders are obsessed with this mission of the national interest. I think a few years ago, if you had said American dynamism, people would have kind of wondered what it meant or felt like it wasn't, it wasn't a popular message. Coming out of COVID and realizing all of the areas that really need investment and need software in order to innovate, I think that there is a generation of founders who are really proud to build for their country, really proud to build for their constituencies. You know, the thing we're most excited about too is that these companies are not just based in Silicon Valley. In the year that I've been at Andreessen Horowitz, I don't think I've made a single investment in San Francisco, and I'm pretty proud of that, given that we've made a number of investments. And I think what that's saying is that tech is truly democratizing in the way that a lot of people like, you know, Mark and Ben predicted that, like, at a certain point, tech will be ubiquitous, and it will not only traverse the globe, but really will traverse the country as well. So I think the core thing we're proud of in American dynamism is that these are legacy industries in many ways that haven't yet been touched by software, but the types of founders that are taking on a lot of these problems, they're taking them on in different parts of the country. They're doing it in different ways, and they're not afraid of tackling the built world.
It's quite incredible, honestly. I mean, you called out a couple of them, but just the last 2 years alone, COVID, supply chain issues, massive reshoring underway. We've got war going on, energy independence, all of these things that have catalyzed what I think you are well ahead of the curve, but it is driving founders more passionate than ever. Because I like to say these are now dinner table issues. You know, the supply chain is affecting what people can get as consumers, amongst all the other things we talk about. But maybe let's to that point in the thematic setup of our discussion, let's get into more of the realities of scaling a tech company within these legacy industries, whether that's the private market where industrials are still coming up the curve on engaging in digital transformation and learning how to have better software purchasing habits, or in the public market sector, like what you mentioned earlier with defense, breaking down siloed department structures to engage earlier stage innovation more efficiently. Both avenues present nuanced challenges to growth that often, you know, they don't follow the traditional B2B enterprise SaaS strategies and, you know, just get your SaaS napkin out. So maybe one example of that is, all of this talk about the next generation of machine shops. And my own experience, I've had investment exposure to the likes of Xometry and Fast Radius, Desktop Metal and Carbon, and walked the halls of some CNC factories with the Proto Labs leadership. All of them are critically important innovators that take time to scale. And you can't just simply hack your way into the world with a bottoms up PLG motion, right? There's certainly benefits to a part of that. And you also have exposure on the front row seat to this category with your investment in Hadrian that you wrote about in another great article you released called Innovating Mom and Pop Machine Shops for Aero and Defense. So all that build up there, when your team invests, how do you think about scaling new entrants within these legacy industries? And what are you advising founders on topics like go-to-market and burn and hiring velocity, et cetera? Would love to hear how you're thinking about it going in.
Sure, sure. So, I mean, it might just be best to start with sort of how we came to invest in Hadrian, because I really do think it's a unique company and a unique mission. And you know, I think in some ways, just talking about sort of the types of founders that are needed to build in these categories is really important. So, you know, Chris Power is the founder of Hadrian. He has an incredible story. He moved from Australia to San Francisco about 4 years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, just hell-bent on rebuilding the defense industrial base. And originally, His view was he would raise a small roll-up fund and potentially buy some machine shops, and really in some ways kind of do what is the tried and true model, which is a lot of these machinists are hitting 60, 65. They don't have children who want to take over the machine shop, and so they sell to private equity, and these get rolled up into various vehicles. And so he looked at that, talked to machine shops around the country, and sort of realized that this was a bigger problem than he even anticipated. That the defense industrial base, which is made up of thousands of mom and pop machine shops around the country, has a coming crisis where we do not have enough machinists who are trained or people to take over these shops in order to supply the big companies, the big industrial companies, the big defense companies, the big aerospace companies. And so he actually shut down the small fund that he had raised, returned capital to investors and said, I have to build from scratch. I have to build a software-enabled machine shop that is ultimately going to automate the difficult parts of machining and make machining an accessible career to millions of Americans who should be doing this type of work, but maybe don't have access to the sort of professional training that it takes in order to become a world-class machinist. And so he started building Hadrian as a venture-backed company, and quickly just found what I would call like extreme product market fit, grew very quickly from factory one to factory two, works with a number of aerospace and defense companies and companies that we all know well. Basically, building parts faster, cheaper, using automation, and building what we would say is sort of like the software experience into the machine shop sort of product, both internally and also on the customer facing side. And what I think has just been so exciting to see about Chris's vision is that it really touches, because it is one layer under, because it is the supplier layer. It really touches all of the companies that so many of the companies we work with on aerospace and defense. It really touches, all industrial companies where you see so many people saying, like, we need this. Like, he's touched on, this is the core sort of crisis that not only are companies thinking about in terms of like, how do we get, the critical parts that we need in order to either launch a rocket or produce a vehicle. But also what Washington's worried about, it's like, if you're following kind of the war in Ukraine and sort of the coming worries that are happening here is that, like, you go to Washington, you hear people say, we've in some ways depleted, our defense industrial base. And why is it that we have a 2-year backlog on Stinger missiles now? And when you think about sort of how difficult it is to produce for a lot of these companies, Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, these are companies that like depend on this defense industrial base, depend on these critical parts that are not easy to manufacture. So we need more, automated machine shops to arise near the customer and to be able to sort of, replenish that depleted backlog of parts that are critical in order to supply these companies. So what I think is, to kind of get to the broader part of your question, these companies take an extraordinary founder. They need I always say the origin story matters. They need a founder who's done the work, who's done the years of research, talking to machine shops, thinking of it from almost an investment perspective, understanding the capital structure. One of the things that I've really enjoyed about Chris and kind of hearing people's perceptions of him is that even though he's a first-time founder, his understanding of financing businesses like this is really just extraordinary for someone who hasn't built a company before. And so you sort of need to be able to look at these companies from all angles, from the investment angle, from the capitalization angle, from the tech angle. Where are the places where technology actually can plug into a machine shop? Some of the companies that have failed in this category before either tried to automate too much of the process or too little of the process. Where is it? What's the right blend? What's the right sort of talent mix? The thing that Chris always talks about is that, like, he's putting machinists and, MIT PhDs side by side to build. How do you manage a culture like that? So I think there's a lot of kind of critical questions when you're building a fast growing startup that is so important to so many industries, but with a lot of complexity around it, that it really just takes an extraordinary founder. And frankly, requires also capital. So someone who's good at fundraising and someone who understands, how to leverage capital in order to really, build capacity for the customer. So we've been really excited about this investment. And in some ways, it sort of touches on a lot of the themes of American dynamism, not only the need to shore up the aerospace and defense supply chain, but also this question of upskilling the American workforce and making sure that we use software and that we use automation in order to empower the next generation of machinists, the next generation of of tradespeople, so that they can operate in the 21st century.
Well, it's an amazing backstory, and I think I caught some of Chris's talks at a prior Miami conference. The passion exudes from that guy, and certainly he's been very thoughtful of how he came to thinking about what Hadrian has become. So it all does come down to the founder and the story they tell, because this ecosystem does take hard, consistent work year over year. I have yet to still see any kind of T2, D3 overnight success. Doesn't mean it can't be a great outcome from everyone involved, but it is hard to solve real world problems where bits often meet atoms in a lot of ways. So, well, maybe the next question, this is one our audience loves. They always want to hear about trends or areas that have, the fastest moving adoption with maybe some of these emerging tools that we've talked about. So in the section that we like to call what's hot and what's hype, any thoughts about, which technologies or innovation approaches are hot to you that you think are currently be deployed at scale? And then maybe on the flip side, what are areas of innovation that certainly have promise, but maybe to use the Gartner term, are overhyped right now, given some immature commercial readiness? Would love your thoughts on some sectors.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a number of areas that we're really excited about. And it's interesting, like, rather than focusing on sort of like the technological changes or the tech underlying some of these companies, like I'd say in American dynamism, we focus a lot on vertical. So, we've made a number of aerospace investments, and a number of the aerospace companies that we're excited about are ones that are really focused on this sort of supplier, kind of focusing on being the supplier and the supply chain versus companies that are going full stack. And what I think is interesting is, like, the kind of supply side, of selling, not only to primes, selling to the government, but also just focusing on where are kind of the capacity constraints or where are the things where you actually need to beef up production. That's been interesting because for a very long time, particularly in aerospace and defense, there was this view that you really have to go full stack. You have to manufacture everything in house. And that there are certain requirements you have to meet. And so it's just much easier to own your supply chains. And I actually think a lot of that sort of thesis came from companies like Tesla and SpaceX, where there was just a view that you could have a lot more control if you're not outsourcing. But I think what we're seeing now is that there's just so much demand and so much innovation that you are seeing sort of these companies that really see themselves as sort of being the OEM supplier to a number of large primes, like that could be a really interesting business model. So we've made some investments there. I'd say the other areas that we're really excited about, we're really excited about future of housing. And there's a lot, I think, happening on the material side. For a while, there were a number of companies that were really focused on ADU, accessory dwelling units. How quickly can you build, one or two room homes in the backyard, to kind of solve the housing crisis. But I think we're seeing more and more companies that are focused on, like, the material side or the supply chain side of how do you build faster, or construction, using certain elements of automation in order to manufacture housing or houses faster. We're also seeing these companies, for a long time we were seeing many of these companies pop up in California because of regulatory changes. And now we're seeing these companies all over the US really experimenting with how quickly you can work with developers. So in some ways, I think we'll probably next year, if I'm trying to predict where we're going to be making investments, I'd say housing is a category, and housing broadly defined in terms of the, the types of companies that are ultimately solving the housing crisis. But I think we'd be making some more investments there, and particularly focused on sort of the physical aspects of housing. So that's one area where I think there's going to be more investment, and where it's not overhyped. There's definitely a lot of room to grow.
That's a great one. I mean, our own portfolio company, Icon, building 100 houses here in Austin, and that's just a drop in the bucket for multiple players to come make a really, really big impact on our national interest. It couldn't agree more. And I did want to plug on the space tech side, since you brought up Aero. I think one of your colleagues, didn't they just release a report? Would you mind, what was that report called so our listeners can find it?
Yeah, so my partner, my partner Ryan just wrote Why America Must Develop Space and How We'll Do It. And it's a fantastic read. I won't do it justice if I'm trying to do the summary, but I think one of the things that is sort of the core thesis of his argument is that there's a moral necessity in developing space, that we are in a next generation space race, and that the private sector is going to be extremely involved in what we would call sort of the next 10, 20, 30 year space race. And that's already happened. SpaceX is certainly leading the charge, but there's a number of new space companies that are also extremely important to sort of revolutionizing space. So I would encourage everyone to read it.
Awesome. The race is on for sure. Well, Catherine, maybe a final question here. We always love to bring the discussion back to those in the arena, the founders, and give them some wisdom for those of them that are out there either raising venture capital or thinking about, approaching the American dynamism practice. You know, split some words of wisdom between some keys to success they should be thinking about to get off on the right foot and maybe any common pitfalls or challenges for them to avoid.
Sure. Well, so the thing I'll say is that there's never been a better time to build a company in this space, and this space broadly defined. Like it is, 5 years ago, it would have been, pushing the boulder up the hill, trying to convince people that hardware, software is the right approach. But I very much believe, because of the enthusiasm from investors, the enthusiasm from the market, and the number of engineers who very much want to be working on these hard problems, it is a great time to build. And it is a great time to start, a seed stage startup, early stage startup, and to sort of ride this important wave that I think is going to be sort of the focal point of technology in the 2020s. What I'll say is a common pitfall that's come up recently, and I do think that more and more founders should think about this is, one of the positives about this sector is that these founders come from everywhere. Oftentimes they come from government, or they come from industrials, or they come from what we would call almost like non-traditional backgrounds entering tech. And the reason why they're so good at solving problems in this space is because they have that domain expertise, they have a different way of thinking. And we're really excited that there is sort of this democratization happening where people who previously wouldn't have considered starting a company are starting a company. Where there's a pitfall is thinking that the culture of where you're coming from is like the culture you're entering, and that the pace of innovation, the pace of build, that they have any similarities. And so what I encourage founders to do is to bring all their domain expertise, but to leave all of the culture behind, all the culture of government, all the culture of legacy companies, and to really, really start from scratch in terms of trying to learn the wisdom of the Valley, trying to there's so many great podcasts like yours. There's so many people who in the last 10 years have really opened up the playbooks of how you build world-class companies. We do this as a firm, but it's never been easier to get that sort of, and I hate even calling it an MBA because an MBA won't do you justice either, but to get that sort of business education and that sort of tech education from the internet. You could listen to 10 podcasts and really understand that tech is very different than a lot of how legacy companies are built. And where I think founders sometimes get trapped is thinking they understand the culture, or thinking that they can bypass that very difficult sort of cultural immersion that's necessary. And what used to happen was people used to move to San Francisco, or they used to move to Silicon Valley, and they used to shed all the bad habits of what they picked up from previous from previous industries. I know I did that when leaving Washington. And because we're decentralized now, because we're not so Valley centric, it's actually hard to sort of get that sort of almost cultural immersion. And so you really have to do it online. So my advice to any founder who wants to build a venture-backed business, who wants to work with us, is like really immerse yourself in the culture of this digital Silicon Valley. Listen to the podcast, read the books. There's books like Venture Deals that I always tell founders they should read, so they really understand the mechanics of term sheets, so they understand why a safe note and why stacking safe notes can actually be detrimental to them when it looks like such a positive. There's a lot of pitfalls that are covered very publicly by people who've been around the block a few times. And so I would recommend founders really do their research and homework and immerse themselves, either before they start the company or as they're building the company, because it is so, so important to have those people who've built it before, who understand the culture and who understand how venture capital works if you're building a venture-backed business.
So well said. As a former Boeing and GE guy that's turned into venture somehow a few shops later, respect the domain experience, but bring a culture shift. You have to in order to go fast. So I couldn't agree with you more. Well, maybe so we'll have some fun here to wrap up our little section we call quick hitters. So if you're ready for some rapid fire, we'll jump in.
I am.
Okay. What is the number one thing you look for? And I think we talked a little bit about this, but what are you looking for when you evaluate a founder in this ecosystem?
Just pure tenacity. You know, it's like, as you said, these are hard businesses to build. The vast majority of normal humans will just crumble at the complexity and the difficulty and the pounding the head against the wall. So I call like the word that I use to refer to these founders is serious, that they believe they're on a mission either sent from the universe or sent from God in order to solve a problem. And the seriousness with which they approach everything they do, not just the business decisions they make, but how they live their life, how they recruit, how they study up on an industry, just that they are very serious people and that seriousness carries them through the difficult times, because it will inevitably be very difficult to build a business.
I don't have the data, but tenacity and grit, probably out of all the podcasts I've done, numero uno, aligned to a mission critical alignment with what we're doing. So love it. One resource, could be book, podcast, blog, anything you'd recommend to our audience to, as you said, help them school up in this ecosystem.
Yeah. So I mean, I think Venture Deals is a great book to understand just how venture capital works. To understand company building, I always recommend my partner Ben's book, The Hard Thing About Hard Things. Just understanding that, like, when you are in your darkest moments, there are many, many founders who have also been in those darkest moments, and that you will come out. There will be light at the end of the tunnel. So I feel like in some ways that's the book that helps founders get through the darkest parts of their days.
Seminal book. And I do have to put a plug in. You guys, I think, just released an American Dynamism newsletter that I encourage all of our listeners to find online. We could put it in the chat comments as well, but it's a great resource as you guys keep putting out the content. Catherine, one person who should be on the podcast.
I will talk about one of our founders who I think is less well known, but is just building an extraordinary business called Flock Safety in Atlanta, Garrett Langley. I love his story because he is someone who, you know, he set out to say he wanted to build a business that would eliminate crime, one of the loftiest missions that you can possibly build for, and then found himself building a hardware business in Atlanta, gosh, starting in 2017. And the speed at which the company has grown, the lessons of building a hardware software business, of selling to government, of selling to police forces around the country, I think Garrett is just an extraordinarily talented founder and visionary, and someone, again, who was one of these reluctant founders, had no idea how hard it was going to be to build the business that he's built, and has a lot of good lessons that he could probably share on this podcast.
All right. And to your point, you can build it anywhere nowadays. Just have that alignment on the mission. Well, and finally here, best way for folks to reach out to you.
Yeah. So I am very online. So I am on Twitter. I am KTM Boyle on Twitter. And then I'm also accessible on LinkedIn, variety of platforms. But I will say Twitter is where I spend most of my time these days.
Right on. Well, not hard to find you, but not hard to find American Dynamism either, with all of the great content you're putting out, blasting on the scene. Very, very fortunate to have you guys join the party here. And Catherine, thanks for coming on and sharing the story. We'll make sure we put some link to contents and stuff in the comments. But thanks for making a little time to get on.
Terrific. Thanks so much for having me.